ahead and pick the speed up. Your number one now, runway 27, clear to land green dot. Well, nice, guys.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of EAA's The Green Dot, our podcast for anyone and everyone who loves aviation. I'm your host today. My name is Chris Henry. I'm the museum manager here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And with us today, special guest is Nick Bohrer. Nick is an advanced concept lead for the aeroanalysis branch at NASA. And we're going to talk about what it takes to go work on some of the amazing programs that NASA is doing there. Nick, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Well, it's always an honor. It's cool to talk about, you know, when we're talking about experimental airplanes, we're talking about like a Vans RV or something. When NASA's talking about experimental airplanes, it's usually something pretty phenomenal. So really, really cool to talk to you today about this. Let me, you know, it's one of my favorite questions. I ask it like every episode. You know, what first got you really excited about aerospace or aviation?
You know, I think I always was into it for some reason. I can't say, you know, point to a family member that was a pilot or anything else, but there's two events that really kind of stick out to me. One of them was I was still pretty young in grade school, and my brother got tired of me just reading Garfield books, and he said, you should read this book. And it was Flight of the Old Dog by Dale Brown. And it was about a hyper-modified B-52 that goes and does some amazing stuff, and I just really got captivated by that book. And also about that same time was the first air show I went to. It was the 1988 El Toro Air Show in Southern California. And so it was kind of between those two events, I was just hooked, and I wanted to learn and read about and see everything I could to about airplanes. And I wanted to design one of those ones that put me in awe watching it fly overhead.
Wow. So what kind of subjects did you kind of put an emphasis on in school to get good at, to follow that dream?
I'm pretty atypical. I think for most engineers, I was actually pretty terrible in math, but it was mostly because I just didn't really connect it to what I wanted to do. And I know that sounds terrible. But one of the things that honestly, that really carried me through, especially once I realized how important all that math was that I always loved building Legos as long as I can remember. So I was always trying to figure out how to make something look like something I wanted it to be. And then it wasn't until I was in college when I wasn't doing very well in some of the classes. And all of a sudden, it started to get later in college and we're learning the engineering pieces. And I'm like, oh, that's why I need to know linear algebra. That's why I need to know calculus. And that was the times when I really went back and had to really relearn the stuff I should have learned in the first place. So, I really think I started off from the perspective of wanting to build things and put them together, and later on had to make that connection back to the math and the science of it all.
You know, that I really kind of relate to that. I couldn't wait to get away from math when I was in high school, and then I ended up going to school and becoming an air traffic controller. So somehow I took a wrong turn and ended up in the world of math. So I totally understand it. But when you're relating it to something you enjoy, it sort of becomes a little more easier, or something you're more willing to go put some time into.
Yeah. And that's, I think different people learn different ways. And I do that now, even with my kids, when I'm trying to connect them to, you know, here's why you're learning this math and here's why it might be important for something you do someday. And understanding that why was really the key to the motivation to understanding in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, tell me just, you know, a little bit about going to college. Where did you go, and what kind of subjects did you have to take on, and how was that experience?
Sure. So I knew I wanted to go into aerospace engineering. So I looked into schools that offered aerospace engineering as a degree. And I've always been more interested in the aero than the space, I'll state. My dad actually taught at Syracuse University. He taught biochemistry there. And so I moved from Southern California to Central New York. And a big draw of doing that, of course, was that because he taught there, I didn't have to pay tuition to go there. So that's always a big draw. But I learned from a lot of great professors at SU. And also that was my involvement there. I got involved into the design, build, fly competition, which I really enjoyed. And that's building a small RC airplane that, conducts various missions. And that was entirely outside of classes. So that was my first real hands-on experience with anything, going from design to flight and it really hooked me. I didn't actually anticipate going to graduate school until I started interviewing for jobs. And I said, you know, I think I need to know more before I get into design. I don't feel like I know enough. So I ended up applying and getting into a couple of schools and ended up at Georgia Tech for my master's. And I was having such a good time on doing stuff with my master's degree, and I was in such a good group of folks. I said, sure, I'll stick around. And I ended up getting my PhD, but it wasn't starting, you know, like a, oh, I'm going to go get my PhD. It just was sort of the way the path led me, I suppose, the way to put it.
Oh, that's fantastic. Sometimes that path, you know, it changes direction a little bit. So that's cool that you had the flexibility to do that. What was your pathway into NASA? What did that look like?
So when I was actually right after I'd finished my master's degree, I had applied for a fellowship at NASA, which was called the Graduate Student Researchers Program Fellowship. The fellowships have kind of changed since then, so this one doesn't exist anymore. But I was able to get this fellowship at NASA Langley, which is where I'm at now, with the then was called then the System Analysis Branch, which is the branch I work for now. So I got to work on a lot of advanced aircraft concepts and studies in support of my graduate research, and also meet some fantastic and incredible folks here. And I have to also say, I really extensively use the technical library here at NASA as part of my dissertation for part of the research I was doing, as well as interviewing some of the folks that I worked with. Two of the members of the branch were actually on my committee. And when I finished up, I said, hey, I'd love to come work there. But this is a time of some kind of changes in the overall NASA mission. And so the aeronautics mission was not hiring at that time. So I went off to actually work for a company called Draper Laboratory for 7 years. And I kept in touch with folks, and they said, hey, by the way, we're hiring again. And I applied. And that's why I've been here in the same branch at NASA Langley since 2013.
Well, you have to tell us, for all of us who have ever dreamed of working at NASA, you know, how does it feel to get that letter in the mail with the NASA, you know, logo on it that says, you know, welcome, you're coming in here? That's got to be an amazing feeling.
Yeah, there's few things that are comparable. And it really is, you know, especially after kind of thinking that wasn't going to be a possibility when I was first entering the workforce after grad school. To, you know, see that position out there. And I said, you know what, I'll apply and I'll see what happens. And my now oldest son had just been born, and we weren't quite certain we were going to uproot. And I'll tell you what, that's a lot changes when you get that letter and you say, nope, we're moving. we're going to make this happen.
Oh, that's awesome. Can you tell me about, like, your first impression of being there? That had to be, it just got to be kind of a starstruck moment walking in the door there.
It's actually the thing that I remember driving past the sign there at the front gate coming in is when it kind of flooded in and it's real. You do your orientation in the headquarters building at Langley, and my building was way on the other side. And what's kind of interesting is we've since moved around, and now I'm in that building. So every time I walk past the sign that says, you know, NASA Langley Research Center right there, I still kind of think about that first day. It's still something that sticks with me.
Oh, that's cool. What was the first project you got to work on there?
Pretty much since I've been here, I started working on electrified aircraft concepts. And if you've been following some of the work in advanced air mobility and electric vertical takeoff and landing, you might have heard of Uber Elevate. And if you've been following Uber Elevate, you might have been following Mark Moore, who was one of the folks that helped found some of that work. And my first job was working under Mark, doing this thing called distributed electric propulsion, and trying to come up with some of the trades that this could introduce to the aircraft design. And I have to admit, I was kind of a skeptic of electrified propulsion and distributed electric. I wasn't quite certain that it would work out. But once you started doing the math, I said, wow, there's some opportunities here. And so very early on in my start, after some of these fundamental trades, NASA Aeronautics reorganized a little bit, and this new project came about that really encouraged seedling level type research, kind of grassroots ideas, trying to bring them into flight. And from that, the activity that ultimately led to X-57 was born. So I've been with the X-57 or whatever it was called prior to that, which was SEPTER or CEPT, from its inception. And that was pretty much, you know, working from distributed electric propulsion all the way through the X-57 project. Is, you know, that's what I started on pretty much when I came here.
Well, so for those who are listening who maybe aren't familiar with it, can you tell us, you know, about the X-57, the goals of the program and just what it was?
Yeah. What's really exciting about this is how much this industry has changed in such a short amount of time, really. So when the predecessor efforts to what would become X-57 started, really a lot of the time was spent convincing, does electric even buy its way onto the airplane in any sort of mission? And there's no secret that batteries are really, 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 really heavy compared to the amount of energy that they hold. But electric motors have some really interesting properties compared to gas motors that really start to challenge the long-standing trade-offs that you usually make in aircraft design. And in particular, we see some potential opportunities for them at smaller scales, especially earlier on. And I myself am a GA pilot, so I love small airplanes. So we wanted to highlight how electrified propulsion could be used to challenge some of these trades. So distributed electric propulsion, one of the big concepts of this is that instead of using one big motor, you might be able to use a whole bunch of little motors. In a traditional gas-powered machine, thermodynamics doesn't like that. It says the more you divide it up, the smaller you make each individual part, the less efficient it gets, the lower the power to weight ratio, everything else. With electric, that's not necessarily the case. You can keep the same power to weight ratio, and you can keep some really high efficiencies as you distribute it. So all of a sudden, having a lot more motors doesn't penalize you like it might with a gas motor. And obviously, there's a lot of different caveats and trade-offs. So we wanted to show some of the positive benefits that distributed propulsion could have with X-57. And so we started off with really just showing how it could buy its way on. We had two elements that we thought we would try to showcase with X-57. It was high lift propellers, we called them, which basically help to blow the air over the wing faster and can enhance your low speed performance, just like a flap can. And then wingtip mounted cruise propellers, which actually can make it a little more efficient to spin your propellers by spinning against the wingtip vortex. And that's how we started off with X-57, wanting to showcase these two new types of potentially game-changing integrations of propulsion on an airplane.
Wow. What were some of the challenges you'd have to overcome when you guys were actually starting, you know, development? There had to be some pretty big ones.
Yeah. The old adage is one miracle at a time in flight test. And that's how we started. We thought we could really just take what was out there in terms of motors and batteries. There were some airplanes flying that were electric at the time. So we had hoped we'd be able to access some of those motors and batteries and really focus on the integration of these propulsion technologies with the airplane. What ended up happening was we couldn't access some of those technologies. So we ended up having to also develop some of our own motors and batteries, of course, with our contractor and subcontractor team. But that's always a challenge, right? You know, a lot of times when you design a new airplane, you don't design a new airplane and an engine. So designing a new airplane, a new engine, and then in our case, a new fuel system, new battery system, that's a lot of miracles. And those systems take a lot of iteration and a lot of time, even on their own. Trying to do all three at once quickly kind of snowballs the challenge.
Now, how would that work? Would there be different teams working on, like, one on the power plant, one on the design, or was it kind of one big pool of engineers?
It's a bit of a mix of both.
Okay.
So a challenge also can be, where you're always competing with resources from other areas. So a lot of times the way that we ended up operating, we kind of needed to solve, we tried to solve one problem at a time. We'd have one team dedicated to one area, another team dedicated to another area. But if one area started having a problem, it might start siphoning some people over. So if you had a larger team or a larger pool of resources you could pull from, you might be able to solve problems more in parallel. We ended up needing to solve a lot of things kind of in a mixture of serial parallel. But I think one of the things we're pretty proud of from this whole effort was we actually spurred a lot of investment in this space, in particular among small businesses. So our prime contractor still is a small business that has grown substantially in this area. the folks that made our motors was this little company called Joby Aviation. Huh. Joby's now a multi-billion-dollar publicly traded company.
Yeah.
And our battery supplier, contract number one, went to them as Electric Power Systems, which is a leader in this in the advanced air mobility battery space. And so I'm certainly not going to say they owe all of their success to the work on this, but that those efforts spent trying to tackle those tricky problems, I think, really helped spur some innovation in the sector. And we're very proud of that.
Well, as you guys should be. And, you know, it's so interesting to look back at NASA's history, and it's just like the Apollo program or the shuttle program, where, you know, the things being developed and used for spaceflight a lot of times also end up, you know, in general population. You know, we have that, we have NASA to thank for a lot of stuff that we have in our house every day, you know, was first developed for the space program. So that's pretty cool that, you know, and some of those companies actually come to Oshkosh. So that's very interesting. How big, you know, what was the general size of the X-57? How big was this aircraft, you know, is the aircraft?
Yeah, it was, so we targeted it ultimately, by the end of the program, ended up at about 3,200 pounds with full margin. We started from an existing general aviation airplane. It's a Technam P2006T. It's a high wing twin engine airplane with two Rotax 100 horsepower engines, so four place. So, you know, think of it as kind of a twin engine 172, 182 size airplane. So not exceptionally big, but just big enough that we'd be able to work on it and put some of these experimental systems on without having to make crazy modifications to the fuselage. We really wanted a twin engine airplane because we wanted to focus on the distributed electric propulsion of the wing. So we needed something where we could take the wing off and put a new one on, but not massively change the weight and balance because we're not, you know, taking something out of the nose, a big propulsion system out of the nose. And we wanted something that was in production because then we could have some support, some drawings, some analyses we could work with from the manufacturer that would jive with some of the new systems that we were developing.
Wow, that is incredible. I mean, how long did you work on the X-57?
So the whole, we got our X designation in 2016, but, you know, the predecessor work, so really began in October of 2014. And the project sunset at the end of October of 2023. So I guess that puts us at 9 years there.
Wow. So, you know, you mentioned the phrase sunset, the aircraft or the project is sunset, but there has to be so many lessons that we learned out of this. Just like, you know, our museum here in Oshkosh, we have a ton of experimental airplanes. Some of them are one-offs, you know, that were like, hey, they built it, you know, I need to change this or that or something like that. But there's always lessons learned from experimental aircraft. Can you tell me about some of what you guys learned along the way here?
Sure. And we don't have time for all of it, I got to say.
That's all right.
There's a lot. So actually, one thing if you want to find information on it, if you just Google X-57 technical and NASA, I think the X-57 technical publications page comes up. There's over, I think, 100 publications on there. You know, one of the keys things, and I think a key differentiator from NASA is we publish as we learned along the way here. And so, you know, a lot of things are there, including the warts, because the warts are sometimes where you learn the most. We were trying to actually do multiple successive modifications of the airplane. So it wasn't just here's the new electric airplane. We wanted to show how this changeover to electric and distributed electric, and what were the incremental benefits of each. So we started from the gas airplane. We measured its performance. We had what was called Mod 2, and that just took the gas engines out and put in cruise electric motors and batteries. And we said, now let's measure the difference in performance and the difference in efficiency. And then we put on our distributed electric propulsion wing in Mods 3 and 4, and we checked out the change in cruise efficiency and then the change in the low speed performance. So we actually developed a lot of the systems for all of these mods. And so the new cruise motors, what we called the high lift motors, I did wind tunnel testing of the high lift propeller system. That worked great and full scale in our wind tunnels here at Langley. That included this passive folding mechanism that we had developed. It was really great to see. We built this all composite high aspect ratio wing that actually used a lot of structural features of sailplane wings. That was pretty pioneering in terms of for an aircraft of this class. And then even a lot of the troubleshooting and some of the things that ended up kind of hampering us in the end with electromagnetic interference, highlighted some of the new materials that we developed along the way, and the overall approach. I know we've heard some of the folks in the AAM community speak very specifically about some of the EMI troubleshooting, electromagnetic interference troubleshooting efforts that we did as being pretty beneficial in their ongoing work. So one thing I just want to highlight is, as though, you know, an interesting thing compared to a commercial technology developing. Commercial technology, you want to get to market as quickly as possible. And that makes sense because you got to make money. NASA, you know, our goal is every time something goes wrong is let's go dig into what happened, and then let's write about it and talk about it and get that information out there so the people that are developing these systems can learn from that. So we don't necessarily, or generally don't develop as fast as somebody maybe developing a product going straight to market, but that's kind of a feature of the system and not a bug.
Well, absolutely. What you do there, I mean, is the foundation of creating, you know, the science behind safe flight, you know, and these different, different avenues of flying. I mean, different, you know, sort of pushing those boundaries. That's what X-planes do, is, you know, we do something with them, we learn from it, and then, you know, we take those lessons and apply them to other aircraft. So that's really cool. I mean, I just absolutely am in awe of what you guys do there. Talk to me about putting something in the wind tunnel there. That has to be an exciting day to run the wind tunnel that y'all have there.
Yeah, it was it was doubly interesting because it was one of the first projects to come back on site post COVID, or, you know, during COVID. And so there was a whole other set of things to contend with coming in. And it also happened to be the first wind tunnel test that I had led in terms of coming up with the test points. So there was a lot of different levels of anxiety coming into it. NASA has all sorts of different wind tunnels. Wind tunnels are rated on all sorts of different speed classes. This one is meant for low speed, and in particular acoustic testing of wings and propulsion systems that speeds it up to about 100 knots. So when you're talking about a propeller that's specifically designed to work around the stall speed of a general aviation airplane, that's about the right speed class for the wind tunnel. We borrowed a test rig that had been designed to spin propellers as part of our revolutionary vertical lift technology, or RVLT project, which is looking into some more of these eVTOL-like configurations. But we had a very unique propeller design, this high lift propeller design. It doesn't look like normal propellers. It has a very different cord and twist distribution. We have these folding hinges on it. It's kind of a Grumman fold, if you're familiar with a Grumman fold on something like a F6F Hellcat or something else, this single hinge point fold. And, you know, so there's a lot that has to happen even before you get into the tunnel to create this test matrix. And sometimes, you know, you have some conflicting analysis. Some say it's going to be great. Some say it's not. And, you know, you have to get past a particular hurdle, but it's still the first time you spin it up. You kind of wonder, gee, I sure hope this thing doesn't blast itself apart. But it was fantastic. The wind tunnel team's excellent to work with, masters of their craft, really holding the hand, you know, of a researcher here, first time in the wind tunnel. And I have to say that of all of the stuff we did, what was really neat, we put so much effort into this high lift propeller design, you know, from the very beginning, that it really it performed just about as exactly as expected. We updated one manufacturing tolerance and then added one best practice for how we wanted to coat one of the ends of the springs. But otherwise, from the test article to what was going to the flight article, were basically identical.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. So, you know, as you're looking through it, the aircraft went through four pretty big modifications. At what point does it become like the second, you know, is there a limit where like so many modifications have happened, we're going to call it, you know, stage one or two, or like when does that decision get made that it's like, okay, now it's time to call it, you know, a formal, you know, second stage of this or something like that?
Yeah, I think it was, we broke it into these four modifications just kind of for convenience of bookkeeping. And then, you know, we did set up the test program in these phases. And sometimes, like, if you look it up and you read about Mod 3, which didn't have had the skinny wing, but no high lift propellers, versus Mod 4, which did, we had different versions of the program where sometimes we did Mod 3 and 4 tests at the same time, and they really ended up being the same airplane. It's just Mod 3 was at higher speeds and Mod 4 was at lower speeds. So it was for us, the big changes were, you know, starting from the gasoline powered baseline you know, change out the main power system and then change out the wing are the kind of the ways that I really think about it. We were probably getting close to the limit in terms of number of modifications. We already were running into a challenge of, you know, silly things that maybe you don't think about when you're retrofitting, but we really cut down the wing area when we moved to that new wing, but we kept the same size tail. And that really moves the neutral point of the airplane back. But you can't move the center of gravity of the airplane back too far, or else you're going to tip back on your landing gear unless you move your landing gear back. So that kind of makes the airplane fly like a truck when you have that really big of a static margin, that big difference between your neutral point and your center of gravity. So if we wanted to do much else beyond Mod 4, we'd be really kind of hampered by that sort of change. Another example would be, just if you're, you know, at some point you run out of weight that we can keep adding. So you need to move to a bigger airplane or to a more purpose-built airplane that doesn't carry some of the weight penalties that we were carrying as we made some of these modifications.
Well, you know, you mentioned, you know, and it's something that we talk about a lot in our industry, and I'm sure you do, obviously, in yours. But you mentioned that, like, you know, you weren't 100% sure about electric flight, and you really became an advocate of it. You know, what was it to change your mind? And can you tell us about what you think, why you think electric flight is important going forward?
You know, I fly now and I look in my logbook, and most of the numbers for time in my logbook start with a one or a zero in front of the decimal place. So yes, you can get some longer endurance and ranges out of gasoline. And yes, there are missions that absolutely need them. But there's a whole lot of missions that don't. And to me, the aha moment was, okay, an electric motor is going to be a lot more efficient than a gas motor at the scale. I can understand that, but it's not enough to really just drag all of that weight and batteries on board. But when you can start doing these distributed propulsion things, you make the airplane the aerodynamically more efficient, particularly in cruise. So in the case of X-57, we cut a whole lot of wing area out of the airplane. Normally, that's going to make the airplane stall at a much faster speed, so you need a lot more runway. The distributed propulsion system, the high-lift propellers, bought that stall speed back to normal. And that means now that you can cruise at a much more efficient speed. It's the same reason why Reno Air Racers will, you know, cut off wingtips or anything else. They want to get rid of that wing area at the high speed where you don't need the wing area, where all it's doing is creating drag for you. So I see things like electric propulsion as ways of enabling distributed electric, which can help you sort of right size your wing for the cruise conditions rather than have to compromise between the low speed and the high speeds that you can get. And it's more appropriate, I think, for smaller airplanes because they tend to want to take off and land in smaller runways, so they have lower stall speeds. And you also don't have as much volume in the wing to add other high lift devices like really fancy slats and flat, you know, triple slotted flaps and these sorts of things that help the big airliners operate efficiently at high speeds and still take off and land in the speeds they need. That was the force multiplier, the interplay between the efficiency of electric and the high power to weight ratio, and the fact that distributed electric enabled more aerodynamically efficiently designs at cruise. That's why I've become an advocate for this technology.
Well, I love, you know, I kind of love the fact that you kind of came in not sure and actually working on the subject matter led you to becoming an advocate for it. I think that's really cool. I think that's really cool. There's something about overcoming that sort of, I don't want to say fear, but maybe just not understanding of the capabilities.
And I'll state, you know, I am not at all going to say that we're going to have electric 737s tomorrow. This is not the same propulsion revolution in terms of just overnight people stopped using piston props and went to jets for so many things. There are places for all of these propulsion technologies. There's places where this is just not going to work very well for a long time, if ever. But I think it's in the places of, in particular, smaller airplanes, especially commercial type aviation. You think about the missions that a lot of the, you know, the nine-seater Part 135 carriers are doing that are only going 100-ish miles, something else. That's a place where I think we could really bring down cost and really increase the market size compared to some of the more niche routes where it's affordable to do it today just because the alternative is, you know, a four-hour ferry ride or something else. I think you could really open up some of those markets with this technology.
That's super cool. I'd be all in. If I can avoid a 4-hour drive, I'd be in.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about, well, one thing I have to ask because it's EAA, what do you fly? You mentioned you fly general aviation.
Yeah, I'm a member of a flying club. We have a Cessna 172, a 182, and a Diamond DA-40. I've been an EAA member. I joined in grad school when I went to Sun and Fun in 2003. And at one point in my life, I was scratch building a Bear Hawk in my garage. But at some point, work and kids' activities and other things sometimes kind of push that out. But I have a 9-foot brake I built in my garage for when I want to get back to my spar webs. So.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. You're going to fly that thing one day.
That's right. That's kind of like Johnny Cash. I figure I'll have it all by the time I retire.
That's it. One piece at a time. Love it. So one of the things I want to ask you, I know we're fighting the clock a little bit here, but I want to make sure I'm respectful of your time. But, you know, if there's a young person out there listening, we have a good bit of young listeners. You know, what piece of advice would you give them if they want to go work at NASA and do what you do?
So I think an important part is to remember just the thing that just kind of always pushes you through is remember the passion that brought you there. Number one, I know it might sound a little cliche, but that's going to during, while studying differential equations or whatever else, trying to remember and connect what you're doing, to why you might be otherwise suffering through something is going to be very, very important. And I think it's just also, you know, find all of the ways you can to connect to that passion, because that's what's always going to, I think, going to make you stand out from other folks in the crowd that have great grades, that otherwise have a lot of experiences. But it's just, you know, show how what you are doing connects to that passion that is bringing you to a place like NASA or to NASA. And the other one, I don't know that it gets that I want to make sure that I advertise is intern.nasa.gov. That is the place for a lot of folks looking for opportunities with NASA that are still in school. I think from high school all the way through grad school, it's not just internships. There's things like our co-op type program. It's called Pathways. So there's a lot of opportunities that get posted on there. We love working with interns here in my branch. So I think that's important. And my last bit that I'll state is on if you do apply to something there, recognize, especially in the summertime, I might be looking over thousands, and it's hard to look over thousands of things. So you kind of have to cull. You know, one of the things, NASA attracts all sorts of people interested in space, people interested in science. Just make sure you mention that element, because, you know, I'm looking for people interested in airplanes. So somebody says, I've wanted to be a part of NASA and become an astronaut. I'm like, that's fantastic. I really hope you find something like that. But the position that I'm advertising for is looking into performance analysis for airplanes. So it's, you know, make sure that you kind of tailor whatever you put into that system to what the position is, rather than just kind of blast a bunch out there.
Well, you know, I'm so glad you mentioned that for a long time. And I'm sure a lot of people are guilty of it too. You know, when I hear NASA, I just think of, you know, space, but really the roots of NASA, of course, NACA, you know, was airplanes. I mean, so it's so interesting that there are so many careers at NASA that it's way deeper than I don't want to say just astronaut, because I highly respect astronauts, but there's a lot more different avenues than just that one pathway in. And that's really remarkable. I've always thought it was interesting, the flying that you guys do with aircraft. You know, like, you know, I'm just throwing stuff out there, but like WB-57s and stuff like that. You guys are doing way more stuff than only space. And I think that's really cool. I'm not always sure that our public knows enough about the aviation sector of what y'all do.
Yeah, and we're always happy to talk about it, and that's one of the reasons why it always gets me excited to get on shows like this or to go out to events like AirVenture and interact with the public and spread the good word of what a lot of folks do here.
Well, Nick, thank you so much for taking some time out of your schedule. I can only imagine how busy you are at NASA. Thank you for taking the time out to talk with us. Thank you for the, you know, Teresa and Sarah who helped set this up. You know, without them, we wouldn't be able to do this. And thank NASA. Thank you to NASA for all the support you guys always give us. It anytime I've ever reached out for a speaker for our Space Day programs or, you know, something we were doing here at Oshkosh, everybody there from the first person I talked to the last, is just so wonderful and great ambassadors of our program, our air and space programs there. So thank all of you, for everything you guys are doing out there.
Well, it's our pleasure. And you know, even beyond that, I love that it's part of our mission too. So I'm very happy to do it.
Well, thank you. And thank you guys for everybody that's listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. We'll be back with another episode, probably in 2 weeks after hearing this. Thank you for all the nice comments you guys leave us. If you're depending on where you hear this, you're always able to get it wherever you find your podcast, things like iTunes and things like that. Again, thank you for all the wonderful comments and feedback, and we will catch you next time when you're cleared to land on the green dot.